touchdown machine for the Houston Cougars.
Sasser again, just kind of taking over right now.
That's NBA stuff right there. He is a baller.
Stick it in your pipe and smoke it, baby.
Yes! Welcome to the Scott Holman Podcast. We are back at our blistering pace of two episodes a week here. Two episodes in 3 days, actually, more specifically. Back in our usual midweek fall sports roundup football preview spot. And in addition to that somewhat anxiety-inducing home opener against the newly competent Kansas Jayhawks, and who were later joined by our 10-12 network friends at the Rock Chalk Pod to discuss, we have a potential season-defining kind of non-conference we're going to talk about tonight from another program in Cougar Fall Sports. Dustin, my friend and co-host, who I will be watching this Saturday's football home opener with in person at TDECU Stadium in just over 72 hours from us recording here. How are you doing, bud?
Yeah, man, I'm feeling good. I'm excited for the aforementioned big Cougar win for the volleyball program that we're going to talk about here in a little bit. Excited what that could mean for the rest of the season. Excited to see if soccer can kind of reinvent itself as it gets into conference play. And yeah, excited for the Cougar football home opener, which is, you know, as much as we're two games into the Cougar football season already, I've already seen a Cougar game this year because I went to San Antonio for that game. I did just like literally just earlier this evening kind of get there like, oh yeah, I'm going to get to see a game in TDECU for the first time since last fall. So very excited about that.
Got to mention at the top here, we are proud members of the 10-12 Network, talking all things Big 12, including your future Big 12 Houston Cougars. Go follow them on Twitter at TEN12 Network. Please listen to the 10-12 podcast, wherever you put podcasts, in your ears. We also had some great conversations this week outside our network with our friend Robert at Houston Sports Talk. Dustin, you were also on with our UCF friend Jeff at the AAC Daily. And of course, check out Dustin and I's interview with the Rock Chalk Pod and our friend Andy, who comes on here later in the show to give them some U of H perspective on this Saturday's matchup. And of course, we're brought to you this evening by our favorite vintage collegiate apparel provider. That's Homefield Apparel, the good folks at the good brands. I always say homefieldapparel.com. If you have not done so already, Cougar fans, please check out Homefield's recently refreshed Cougar collection, including a couple of really natty Sailor Cougar designs, a fantastic Five Slam and Jamma tee from their original U of H collection. But no matter your rooting team of interest, you, the listener, can save 15% off your first order by entering the promo code Holman12, that's H-O-L-M-A-N-1-2 at checkout, like Scott and Holman. Worth reiterating, like I think I do most weeks when we talk about Homefield, that the collection they have over there is really unmatched for depth and quality. There are a lot of apparel companies out there outside of, you know, maybe the biggest names. You'd really be hard-pressed to find quality selections outside of your big names, and Homefield's collection, no matter whether it's your Blue Bloods, your Oklahomas, Florida, Georgia, etc., or whether your team of rooting interest is someone like Youngstown State or Slippery Rock or Hope College, Homefield's quality at all levels is simply unmatched. That's the kind of, you know, thing that makes us so enthusiastic to be cheerleaders for this company, come on every week and tell you about Homefield Apparel. So that's homefieldapparel.com, promo code Holman12. Improve your Houston Cougar collection. Help our podcast. Do it all at the same time in all one fell swoop. Got to lead off here with what was really an incredible weekend for Cougar volleyball. There is a lot of season left. It bears repeating, but going 3-0 over this past weekend at the Maroon and White Invite at Mississippi State is a statement. It is a bolded, underlined, italicized statement of intent. Dustin, am I overstating the weekend the ladies had out in Starkville?
No, I think that's definitely fair. You know, sweeping the weekend, going 3-0, most importantly, getting the big road win over Mississippi State. The Cougars actually opened the weekend looking a little bit unsteady. They took the first two sets against South Alabama before letting USA back into it by winning sets 3 and 4. Fortunately, the Cougars were able to finish that one off, taking the fifth set. But they sure brought their A game later on Friday when facing the host Bulldogs. Mississippi State came into this one, you may remember, 6-0, coming off of a top 30 season. They were top 30 in the polls this year as well coming in. And State came out strong. They won the first set 25-17, but you just saw Houston get linearly better pretty much each set the rest of the way. The Bulldogs won the second set as well, but it was was 25-22 this time. Houston really putting up a genuine fight before the Bulldogs held them off. And then set three, it was the Cougars holding off Mississippi State to win it at the end, 25-22. And then set four, all of a sudden Houston looked like the noticeably better team. They jumped out to an 11-3 lead and pretty comfortably held the lead the whole rest of the set. And then, you know, the final set was close for a little ways before the Cougs closed it off on a 7-1 run to take the third set 15-10 and take the 3-2 win overall. So just really, really impressive team performance. And Sam, a match in which we saw just some unbelievable individual performances as well.
Yeah, this was a Bulldog team who only lost once on their home court in the entirety of last season, have not lost, period, this season so far, besides this contest against the Houston Cougars. This was a really good opponent, and the Cougs beat them on their court and gave this team a signature kind of jewel of the non-conference win that, for all of the positives, for all the consistent improvement, the trend lines going in the right direction under David Rare, wasn't really something we'd seen Cougar volleyball do in the previous few seasons. It did start a bit auspiciously. Like you said, the Cougars were down a bunch early, but made the first set a bit more competitive. Like you said, kind of gradually got more competitive in those, you know, the first two sets that were losses. You know, I think what was so exciting is just how this team, you know, proved pretty emphatically over the final three sets. Because for me, watching it in real time, even though I didn't watch this first game, it kind of reminded me of following along with the opener against Rice. You know, Rice was a three-set loss to a top 25-ish opponent. And, you know, us coming back here and, you know, I think last week wondering if this team, you know, that we think is, you know, good, but is this a team that has the ability to push a top 25 opponent on their court good? And, you know, what was really stressful in those first two sets is that you saw the Cougars really not finish strong. And I think it was really cool to kind of see that go full circle, and that, you know, the Cougs jumped out to that big lead in the fourth set after forcing the third. And just, you finally saw them in that fourth set, and why I was just so confident watching this in real time that the team was going to take care of it and win this match is that you saw them really finish off the Bulldogs in that fourth set. And I know, you know, momentum isn't really a thing as much as I come on here and talk about it a fair amount. You know, momentum is as, you know, existent as your next big play, but it was just a really stressful final set to start. I was kind of thinking, okay, well, maybe this won't be, you know, Mississippi State going quietly into the night. But watching the Cougars, after struggling so much early in this game, win six of the match's final 7 points, I think no more appropriate ending, Dustin, than an Abby Jackson kill to send off the Bulldogs. And like I said, a lot of individual performances worth highlighting. Isabel Toit, Dustin, do you know before this one what Isabel Toit's previous career high in kills was?
I do not know.
Earlier that day against South Alabama, she had 19 kills against the Jaguars. Tops out in the very same day with 20 kills against the Bulldogs. Abby Jackson had 18 on a respectable, just a hair under 30% hit percentage. Also contributed 11 digs. Annie Cook and Morgan Janda combined for 55 assists. Cook also contributed 10 digs. And Kate Georgiadis was excellent as typical, organizing the Cougars offensively, had 26 digs of her own. Just a really impressive win over a really good opponent, Dustin. I don't think you can overstate it in any way.
Yeah, and one of the things that I really liked about it was something you kind of briefly mentioned there, which was seeing David Rare use utilizing both setters, Morgan Janda and Annie Cook. And that was, it's kind of the, you know, analogous to a two quarterback approach in football. And Janda had the team high 36 assists, but Cook had the double-double with 19 assists and 10 digs. And, you know, previously, you know, we'd seen him in the course of one match kind of focus more on one or the other, and really to great effect this weekend, you know, in this match as well as, you know, in the Kennesaw match to follow it, you saw him really utilizing both. And when you've got two setters that are that talented, and Annie Cook, you know, showing that she can play defense with a double-double with the digs as well, you know, I think it's a good thing if you can get both of them out there. And really exciting that Rare is finding a way to do that, and I think that can only be really exciting and good for this team. And yeah, you mentioned Kate Georgiadis, 26 digs, basically right in line with her season average of 5.25 digs per set, which is currently good for number 14 in the country. But yeah, kind of like you said up top there, this is the kind of win you want to have on your resume when it's NCAA tournament you know, time. And this is the Cougar team trying to get back to the NCAA postseason for the first time since the year 2000, and getting their third SEC win of the season, their second SEC road win of the season, and beating by far the best of the three SEC teams that they've played thus far in Mississippi State. Really, really good thing for the Cougs, and is, I think, going to bode really well if they can have a strong conference campaign.
I just wanted to add on to what you said. Speaks to the buy-in, I think, of this team, that two multi-year starters, two all-conference level setters in Yanda and Cook, are willing to share that, are willing to sacrifice being the, you know, A1 starter, you know, to potentially be on this team that's better than any team that either has been on previously in their career.
And then looking forward to this week, the Cougars. To say that they have a tough test coming up would be an understatement. They're facing the number one UT Austin Longhorns in Austin on Thursday. This one's going to be tough. You know, the Longhorns have just been absolutely roughing up, you know, top 15 and top five type teams already in this season, looking they're a near unanimous number one in the country at this point. So I wouldn't even say that winning a set for Houston would be a huge accomplishment, because that would be a massive accomplishment. I think it would be a huge accomplishment for Houston to hit 20 points a couple of times while getting swept on Thursday in Austin. And it's really hard for me to say that, and I would be just the absolute happiest person on earth if this Cougar team makes me eat my words by exceeding the expectations that I have. But you know, I think I'm not going to let it affect my perception of this team, this Cougar team, one iota, you know, basically no matter how bad we, in all likelihood, get swept.
It kind of goes without saying that the near unanimous number one team has an eye-popping resume, and I won't spend too much time hyping up a Longhorn athletic team for obvious reasons, but I think people should realize just a little bit how absurdly good they are. They have 6 wins today, 0 losses. 4 of their 6 wins, Dustin, are against current top 10 teams, and they only lost those 4 wins over current top 10 teams. They only lost 2 sets total in 4 matches against those current top 10 teams. They went to Stanford, one of the sport's most consistent powers, beat them 3-0, and none of the sets were super close. I would say individually also that Logan Eggleston, multi-time All-American, Big 12 Conference Player of the Year one time, Big 12 Freshman of the Year, certainly going to be the best opposing player the Cougs see this year. Would co-sign what you say. If we get to 20 points in any of the sets, it's a positive. If nothing else, just it lifts up your non-conference strength of schedule. You know, if you're looking at season-ending metrics, you know, I know obviously you only get so much from a matchup that you don't win, but you know, any weakness in this non-conference schedule is raised a bit by having a near unanimous number one team at their place in your schedule.
And then on Sunday afternoon, a slightly more manageable match as Houston will be hosting High Point. High Point 7-4 in the year. They did get swept by the Kennesaw State team that Houston just swept. But on the other hand, they did take a set against the top 25 Marquette team. But, you know, I think playing at home, Sam, this is a team that Houston should be able to take out their frustrations on after, let's be honest, losing to the Longhorns on Thursday.
Yeah, certainly a respectable team last year, though. They went 24-7, actually finished 8 slots ahead of the Cougs in the final 2021 season RPI. I don't know if this current year's team is quite as good as last year's team, and you mentioned the 3-0 loss to common opponent Kennesaw State. I would argue still that this team is probably better than any of the 3 we saw the Cougars face previously at home in the Flo Hyman Collegiate Cup 2 weeks ago. Not an opponent to be taken lightly, certainly, but I think one the Cougars should expect to beat as well.
I think we can talk about it now, because as we generally record on Wednesday evening, that means by our next episode, or next non-football recap episode, Houston will have opened conference play, actually, because on Wednesday afternoon, they will be on the road at Tulane. This is a Tulane team that Houston has won 4 straight times against, all 4 times in 4 sets. Tulane struggling this year, 5-4, with losses to Southeastern Louisiana, Kansas City, and Ohio. So definitely after that tough test from the Longhorns, hopefully the Cougs able to pick up wins in their next 2 matches, including what will be their conference opener.
Yeah, that's going to be, I think, the big test this year. How do you do as a team that is expected to win nearly all of your conference games? And, you know, are you able to avoid some, you know, bad resume losses, which this team, for all the success of the last few years, there have always been a couple, you know, kind of hard to explain blemishes in conference play. It would be nice to not start out with that in New Orleans here next Wednesday.
Hey, did someone say bad resume losses? Because that takes us to our next Cougar sports team. Unfortunately, we got to start with what can only be described as a really disappointing result. Cougar soccer losing 3-0 on the road to a, if we're being honest, pretty mediocre Texas Tech team. The Cougs giving up 2 goals within a minute of each other midway through the first half, and then an insurance goal in the 80th minute. And, you know, just as disappointingly as losing 3-0 is Houston just really managing nothing by way of an offensive attack. Only 3 total shots, all of them in the second half, only 1 shot on goal. So just really completely, you know, just outworked and outplayed in every facet by a Texas Tech team that is just not really that good. And a Texas Tech team that, like we said in the preview, had been having a lot of trouble scoring goals, all of a sudden puts up 3, including 2 within a minute of each other. It's against, like I said, a Texas Tech team that could hardly score a goal to save their life becomes the third team to beat Houston 3-0 this year. All three of those losses, you know, not to a murderer's row of teams by any stretch of the imagination. So, you know, I know we're going to talk about a Cougar victory to follow it up, Sam, but I think you got to be really frank if you're going to talk about how the non-conference has gone for this Houston team this year, and to say that it's been pretty disappointing, and the 3-0 loss at Tech kind of underscores that.
I think it's worth repeating that coming into this match, the Red Bears had only scored one goal total in their previous five matches, and that they had scored three for the entirety of the season leading into last Thursday night's game. But by the 29th minute of action, Tech had a two-goal lead. A pair of goals was more than enough. Like you said, the Cougars really weren't able to create any chances consistently in this one. It actually took the Cougars until the 74th minute to get a shot on goal against the Red Raiders, but several minutes later, Tech got that insurance goal, like you said, to put this one away. Bottom line, this is the third three-goal loss this team has taken in only seven matches so far this season under Jaime Frias, and this team did not have a three-goal loss of any kind in either, you know, the fall 2021 season last year or even the previous spring season. And that's not because the strength of schedule is that much more difficult. Those seasons, you know, both feature good teams. You know, U of H faced Rice the year they went to the Sweet 16 in the spring season. U of H faced a number of top 25 opponents in conference play last year and faced TCU, I think a national top 10 team at their place, and still managed not to have a three-goal loss. I think with all due respect to Texas Tech and Baylor, two programs who just clearly showed themselves to be way better in this current season than U of H, those are not Big 12, you know, top echelon programs right now. Maybe they will be in a few years, but these aren't top 25, even top 25-ish teams right now. And if we're about to be competing against these teams in conference play, I personally would hope for something a lot more competitive than two different three-goal losses where neither game really was a fluky outcome. I think I'm not going to, you know, go full diatribe here. I will just say if I had to choose a word for this result, it's discouraging. It's discouraging to me, you know, even more so because this is about to be a team that we're facing year in, year out. And I don't think either of us believe that this team should be three goals worse than Baylor or Texas Tech. If this is a game where Tech wins 1-0, and we knew coming in that Tech, you know, for their flaws, it was a good defensive team, a team that kept a number of clean sheets this season. If this is a 1-0 loss where U of H gives up that, you know, one goal late, you know, a loss is a loss, but I think we're talking about this game in different tones. But this wasn't competitive, and I think that maybe should have been something I expected, just given that we haven't really seen a whole lot to, you know, say that this team is going to be competitive against the better teams on the schedule. But I don't, there's no good answer to me as to why that is. And, you know, maybe things change in conference play, but just a very disappointing way to, you know, I'm not gonna say end non-conference player because we're about to, you know, talk about HBU, but I'm just gonna say it doesn't matter to me what we do against HBU. We're probably gonna beat HBU more years than not. As far as I'm concerned, Texas Tech was the last non-conference game I had some real interest in, and the Cougars looked pretty second best.
Yeah,
I said absolutely. I wouldn't go full diatribe and then dropped an F-bomb, so sorry for that, Dustin.
No. I think it's fair to be frustrated with how the Cougars soccer team has looked in non-conference play. You mentioned it. They did bounce back with a 3-1 win over HBU across town in Sharpstown. Strikers Janice Singleton and Nadia Kamasai got their second goals of the year. Midfielder Caitlin Matthews gave Houston a 3-0 lead in the 66th minute before the Huskies got a late consolation goal. And yeah, sure, it's good to get the win, but you know, HBU is winless in seven matches this year now, so not the biggest win that Houston will have, hopefully. And like you said, not really one that really does anything to kind of wash the taste out of your mouth of the disappointing result up in Lubbock.
Yeah, I'm not going to try to, you know, pick nits. I was kind of hoping U of H would be able to keep a clean sheet here. And granted, the Huskies' one goal in this one was a pretty inconsequential 73rd-minute goal. But it's just like, whew, if we can't keep a clean sheet against HBU, I mean, what's going to happen in conference play? But again, not going to poo-poo a decisive win coming off a tough road loss, and was happy to at least be coming back here and not talking about a loss to the Houston Baptist soccer program.
So Houston's next match is on Thursday evening. They'll be opening American Athletic Conference play for the last time, hosting South Florida. You may remember South Florida and Houston finished 1-2 in that order, the Bulls half game ahead of the Cougars in the AAC regular season standings last year, but Sam, this is, does not look like the matchup we probably thought it was going to be coming into the season, not only because Houston has been disappointing, but because USF is 3-4 this year with losses to American University and Florida Atlantic. So yeah, despite Houston's troubles and despite playing last year's AAC regular season champion, this hardly looks like an unwinnable game for the Cougars if they are able to show up. And I think it gives them a pretty significant chance to kind of, you know, maybe reboot what's been a disappointing season by hopefully opening conference play with a positive result at home.
Yeah, certainly I'm not wildly confident about, you know, the Cougar team here, but I would say I'm a bit more now than I was a week or two ago before I really took a look at the kind of start to the season USF had had. And it sort of makes sense when I kind of dug into it. The Bulls lost some key seniors off of last year's team, like Sidney Nasella, one of the better goal scorers in the conference's recent history. Also Cheyenne Dennis, Katie Kitching, and Sabrina Wagner. And even a perennially good program like USF, when you have a talent drain like that, sometimes needs a year to rebuild. I'm not going to get wildly confident in my prediction. They did have a multi-goal win over Miami in the previous week, but it's not the same powerhouse program that it was a year or two ago. Not the same kind of matchup that, you know, we expected certainly when we looked at the schedule in the preseason.
All right, and then some other sports getting underway in the fall here. Cross country this past week competed at the 46th Rice Invitational. The men finished second behind the host Owls ahead of the rest of the field. That included schools like Sam Houston, Tulane, A&M Corpus, and others. The women finished third behind Rice and just narrowly behind Tulane. The Cougs led once again by their seniors, Claire Meyer on the women's side, Brandon C. Reeves on the men's side. So kind of a similar result to the first week, Sam, where the Cougars faced a fair number of smaller schools in the event, but coming in near the top of the team standings.
Yeah, and for the second week in a row, you had Claire Meyer up there near the leaders on the individual side, was only 2 seconds behind the second place finisher, Rice's Tegan Hunter Galvin. Meyer, like you said, was top finisher in this Cougar team. Real tough competition at the top there. Rice has multi-time All-American, the runner-up in the 10K at last year's NCAA Outdoor, and Grace Forbes. So nobody, as you could expect, was especially close to Grace Forbes, the top on the women's side. Second week in a row, Brandon Seagreaves pacing the men. Cool to see also Devin Vallejo Bannister making his season debut, finished several seconds behind Branch Cox, the Cougars' second highest finisher, in eighth place in the individual top 10 there. So at the very least, it's been good to see Claire Meyer and Brandon Seagreaves consistently near the top of the individual standings in both events so far.
And then the other Cougar sport in action, men's golf, opened their fall season at the Jim Rivers Intercollegiate. The Cougs finished fifth out of 23 teams behind teams like Southern Miss and LSU, ahead of programs like SMU and Rice. Austin Riley, the veteran leading the way for Houston, finishing 7 strokes under par, good for 11th on the individual leaderboard. And then, Sam, a exciting result, Arkansas Tech transfer Santiago De La Fuente was competing as an individual in this one, but was just a stroke behind Riley. So maybe an interesting result, and maybe a newcomer to watch in this Cougar program, Sam.
Yeah, I saw his name when they refreshed the men's golf roster over the summer. Really exciting one. It was one of the top Division II golfers, is a really good golfer on the Mexican amateur circuit as well. And, you know, you look at the team score, you know, 10 under par, fairly far behind, at least looking at the standings, you know, LSU, Southern Miss in the top tier of teams. But if, you know, let's just say Santiago De Fuente isn't competing individually and your worst finisher, Braxton Watkins, isn't, the Cougars are actually 19 under par in that scenario. So, yeah, again, fall result, don't want to read too much into it, but De La Fuente is someone I was excited to see go out there. It's exciting to see Austin Riley, who certainly had his moments last year, you know, won the Texas Amateur in the preseason, was good at some of the bigger events, maybe wasn't consistently excellent, though. I think this is going to be, you know, a very good team. I don't think Marcus Wagner is going to be this bad on a week-in, week-out basis. He probably, you know, played like a guy who hasn't, you know, played in an event for a few months, and I think, you know, Santiago De La Fuente is going to be somebody we can expect in the tournament five. So reasons to be excited, and obviously still some stuff to learn about this team with a couple of key guys gone from last year's group.
All right, Sam, I think that is all the other fall sports, short of the one fall sport that probably the most people want to hear us talk about. So I think it's time to talk some Cougar football.
It sure is, and we brought on I would say somebody who by some miracle of nature has, you know, self-describes as an optimistic Kansas fan, somebody who's incredibly knowledgeable about the Jayhawks. So let's hear Dustin and I get some Jayhawk perspective on Saturday's game.
All right, we're very excited to be joined on the Scott Nolan podcast by Andy from the Rock Chalk podcast here to bring us the scoop on Houston's opponent this Saturday, the Kansas Jayhawks football team. Andy, thanks so much for joining us from our 1012 Network sister podcast, the Rock Chalk podcast. Thanks for taking some time out to chat with us.
Yeah, I know. It's great to be here. I'm going to be honest. This was the game that I was like, I don't know if I can get super excited about this non-conference game, because if Kansas isn't as good as I'm hoping that they can be, and, you know, Houston is as good as they look like they were going to be, like, this could be a very lopsided game going into it. And now it seems like we're going to actually have a good game here. So, like, I'm really excited about this game. I'm sure it's a little bit more stressful for you guys than when we talked over the summer over on my podcast. But, you know, I do think that we have, like, what we were talking about has borne out, right? That your guys' most difficult three-game stretch is the first three games of the season, so.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's looked like a couple of tough games, and the way that Kansas is playing right now looks like another tough game on Saturday. Speaking of, you know, despite a, you know, already going back to the end of last season, despite a 2-10 season, there were already some signs that Kansas was headed in the right direction, most notably another win over the Longhorns, putting a heck of a scare into Oklahoma. But, you know, also in between those games, the Jayhawks got pummeled by Oklahoma State. They weren't especially competitive versus K-State. So, you know, looking back to last year, what was kind of the X factor in terms of the games where Kansas football, you know, was competitive as, you know, the ones that compared to the ones where they weren't?
Well, I don't think there was really that much of a difference. I honestly think that Oklahoma State matched up a whole lot better with what Kansas was able to do last year. And we were still seeing inconsistent results from the Jayhawks last year because they were still learning the system. Like, if you think about when Lance Leipold actually came into Kansas, right, he came in after spring practices, which means that fall camp was really spring practice for him. And then the first half of the season was what you would typically have fall camp in terms of installing the system, you know, getting used to the way that things are supposed to go, terminology, like all of that stuff. So the fact that they started playing better in the second half of the season isn't really that surprising, but there was still a gigantic talent disadvantage for the Jayhawks. You know, we actually talked a lot looking over the season. The Kansas Jayhawks hit the transfer portal really hard, and it was necessary for them. They went from having, you know, barely enough Big 12 caliber players to fill out a two deep, and honestly weren't even able to fill out a two deep at each spot. I'm thinking like linebacker and, you know, safety and cornerback. They didn't really have Big 12 caliber players that could play consistently. And so when they had to dip into that depth, either because you can't play the same two cornerbacks on every single snap of a game, it just doesn't work. They weren't really able to hold that same level of consistency and that same level of performance. What we saw last year from the Jayhawks was they had a lot of good guys that were good as starters, but had no depth behind them at all. And that was across pretty much the entire team. Running back has always been, you know, a good position for the Jayhawks. But it was probably the deepest one that they had. And they added a bunch of, you know, talent there in Sevian Morrison and Kai Thomas as well. But, you know, this is one of those things where this team just was so depleted last year. And you had all of these guys come in, all of these transfers like Craig Young. You know, you had, well, I'm going to try to list all of them because I will definitely miss some and I don't want even to feel left out. But Lonnie Phelps is like the big name that came in terms of what he actually did. And he showed out in the first game. Craig Young played really well in this last game. But there's like what we didn't see was guys transfer in and increase like the top level of what Kansas had. What they did is made it more consistent. So the backups were at the same level as what we had from the starters, and the starters were a lot more familiar with the system. So I think this year it's really just about familiarity, about knowing what it is that they need to do, being able to get in and do those things without having to think about it, which allows them to play at a higher level.
I'm very curious from your perspective on this one as a, you know, Kansas fan, someone who's followed that program quite closely, the whole, you know, never forget that Texas lost to Kansas in football thing has become, I think, an undeniable meme among college football fans around the country since the loss in the 2016 season by the Longhorns, one that got, I would say, blessed new life last year. I think we both think the tide is currently slowly turning in terms of Kansas, you know, being an embarrassing loss to just Kansas being at worst a, you know, pretty solid Big 12 program under Lance Leipold. How do you feel as a Kansas fan when you see people clowning on the Longhorns with that? is it, you know, do you still have the pride in remembering two, you know, I think fun wins during a tough period, or does it feel too condescending for you to really enjoy it, despite it being, you know, objectively very big wins for this program in the last 11 years?
Oh, no. I definitely fully enjoy it. Like back in 2016, like it was a meme because it should have been a meme. Like that was a team. I actually said it back when they won in 2016. This is either going to be the singular highlight of David Beatty's career here at Kansas, and we are going to laugh about it forever and wonder how the hell it happened, or it's going to be the start of the turnaround. And of course, it was the first one. The second one, though, like you saw it because it followed so closely after the Oklahoma game, and then they followed it up the next 2 weeks with good performances. I think one, everybody like, you know, piled on Texas. Ha ha. They lost to Kansas again, this time at home. One, because Texas was not a good team last year. It was really easy to do it. And it was kind of true. Like Kansas had not shown that consistency to show they had turned the corner. Coming into this year, though, like after the first two wins, this last week, you couple that with Texas barely losing to Alabama, and now people are talking about, hey, the loss last year was more of a sign of what Kansas was doing and how down Texas was, as opposed to a, ha-ha, let's laugh the Longhorns, they lost to a team like Kansas. It was more of a, this is the reality of what things are now. Let's actually give that some respect. Like, I understand why everybody made the jokes back then and what the tone was, because I was fully on board. It's like, yeah, I mean, I've been burned by this before, right? Where they get a win against Texas, and unless they follow it up with something respectable, then all we can do is laugh about it. But we saw really quickly what those differences were, and the question was how well they'd be able to build on this year. I was like, I'm probably one of the most optimistic people that follow Kansas. I called, you know, beginning of the year, I'm not sure if you guys have seen all this, but Philip has been putting it all over the place, that, you know, I called them going to a bowl game this year. This was not one of the games that I actually had them winning to be able to do that. So you guys can feel a little bit better about that. But like, this is one of those things where even I did not see a start this good for the Jayhawks. So they have outperformed even my expectations. You know, I think this is probably one of the tougher games left on the first half of their schedule. Actually, probably the toughest game left on the first half of their schedule, which is saying something, just partly because of where it is. Like, it's not at home. Like, this is the last road game before they have three straight home games. But also the fact that I still think that Houston is a good team, and they match up fairly well in some aspects against the Jayhawks. But this is definitely like one of those. I was not expecting them to be this good coming in. I was not expecting Jalen Daniels to be getting Heisman hype from national writers. Like, you know, I jokingly threw out when one of the Kansas beat writers threw out a stat on Twitter during the West Virginia game that Devin Neal had, you know, 13 touches and 5 touchdowns off of those 13 touches. I was like, yeah, Devin Neal for Heisman, not realizing that, you know, really shortly after that game, we were going to start hearing about Jalen Daniels. I think he has been absolutely phenomenal. He is the spark plug that this team needed. But what we have seen is an increase by the offensive line, a lot of other spots of this team that have made it easier for him to actually take his impact and turn it into results.
And you mentioned some of the exciting results from the first couple of weeks with, you know, a strong finish to the season, the win over UT and a couple of close losses to end last year, and then, you know, clobbering Tennessee Tech, the overtime win at West Virginia. And, you know, my next question would be, you know, what's most encouraging to you about what you've seen over the first 2 weeks of the season? But it kind of sounds like the answer to that is everything in terms of the overall depth and Jalen Daniels showing out and the whole team. So, I mean, it's just, is there one area that you can kind of focus in on and say that that's the most exciting, or is it just all good in every direction thus far?
Yeah, I mean, it is really hard to find something to really complain about this team. Like, it's hard to not get excited about pretty much everything. Lonnie Phelps, you know, West Virginia had a good plan for him in the last game, but he was still getting a lot of pressure. It just didn't show up in the box score. You know, he had two face mask penalties, one of which was like he happened to graze a guy's face mask while his was getting like yanked all over the place. But like, he was still getting pressure. He was still impacting plays. And the Kansas defense, I think, didn't necessarily look as good against West Virginia, because West Virginia is actually still, I think, a pretty good team, even though they're 0-2 at this point. But I don't know how you don't get excited the most about this offense. The fact that the offense has so many different options, you know, you have four legitimate running backs that it's impossible to get all of them the touches that they need to actually show what they can do this year. I do think that like Devin Neal and Daniel Hyshaw are probably going to be the primary backs for the rest of the year, and that Kai Thomas and Sevion Morrison will probably have their games. But, you know, if Devin Neal wasn't here, I do think that any of those running backs could be like the lead running back for this team. And then in the wide receiver room, like, they don't have a true number one wide receiver. you could point to any number one of the player or any of those players and say, that's going to be the guy today. And it probably could happen. Like we, you know, Lawrence Arnold is one of the most talented guys there and was expected to take that leading role. But a guy like Luke Grimm is a great possession receiver. You know, you have Kevin Terry is a guy that came out of nowhere. Honestly, I wasn't expecting him. And he made some big catches. Jared Casey at the tight end position has done, you know, a few things. He's not actually the starter, but he's the guy that everybody remembers from the Texas game. But Mason, you know, Mason Fairchild, they've got, Taka Scott had a big catch in this last game, but they've got a ton of guys, Stephen McBride. I could go and name all the wide receivers because they've all actually contributed. That was the thing that I think is the most impressive about what Jalen Daniels is doing, is that he is involving so many different receivers in the passing game that it's hard to keep track of all of them. And, you know, it's not like he's making a bunch of bad decisions to do it. He is actually going through a lot of progressions, reading the situations, and finding the right guy to go to. And it's causing problems for opposing defenses. We'll see how long it continues before teams start to figure out what they can do. But so far this season, it's caused so many problems because you don't know where it's going. I gave the example of the 4th-and-2 catch that that Jared Casey pulled in on the drive that Kansas had towards the end of the first half. I was completely shocked by that one because that's not where I thought it was going. I thought I knew where that play was going, the way it was developing, and Jalen Daniels completely changed it up on the fly when he didn't see a coverage he'd like. So the fact that he's able to do that and able to make those decisions because he has an offensive line that can actually protect him for long enough to make those decisions has made all the difference in the world for the Jayhawks this year.
Every time I've tried to form my thoughts on Kansas football in the lead up to our episode tonight, to talking with you this weekend's game, I can't fathom how Daniels was the Jayhawks' third choice quarterback at any point last year. I mean, I'm just curious, how did guys like Jason Bean and Miles Kendrick start last season ahead of Daniels in the QB pecking order? Is there something that I'm missing? Was he hurt at the start of last season or something?
No, it really comes down to the mantra for Lance Leipold, and it is consistency. They said really early when they came in, we are not going to pick the guy that has the biggest upside, but is not consistent with it. We want a guy that we know what they can do. We know what we're working with, and we can do the same things over and over again. Jalen Daniels was not very consistent coming into last year. And I think a big part of it has to do with the fact that, you know, as a true freshman, he started a decent number of games, ended up getting injured during his first season. But he had an offensive line that wouldn't let him do anything. Like he was literally running for his life less than 2 seconds after every single snap. So he wasn't making good decisions. He wasn't really doing what he should have been doing because he didn't have the time for it. And they were not able to get the offensive line fixed. So last year, I think he struggled in camp picking up the new system that Leipold had. And in a shortened time frame, your older guys are usually able to pick it up faster. And so they went with a guy that they knew that could give them the best floor. Jason Bean is a really good quarterback too. He just unfortunately doesn't have quite as much, you know, dynamic play as Jalen Daniels does. It's a perfect situation where Kansas, I think, actually has two quarterbacks that are consistent this year that they would be comfortable with starting in both Jalen Daniels and Jason Bean. But you've seen what Jalen Daniels can do. This is actually a year, I think, where also Ethan Vasco was talked up really big as the third string quarterback as well. And not that they want to get to a situation where they have to play their third string quarterback. We saw how valuable it was last year to actually have three legitimate quarterbacks that you feel could run your offense because Kansas had to get to one of them before the end of the year. So I do think it's helpful for them to have that, but it is a situation where, you know, Daniels took some time to develop. I think it's because, one, he's such a young player. He you know, joined the Jayhawks when he was a 17-year-old freshman. He actually didn't turn 18 until I think it was like week 10 of his freshman season. So, like, he's a really young guy. And so it's just taken him a little bit longer to get to this level. But now that he has it, you can see the decisions that he's making and just how well he's actually pulled this entire offense together.
When you look at Kansas's relatively quick improvement offensively, especially under Lance Leipold, how much of that do you think is attributed to him being allowed to bring the majority of his offensive staff with him from his previous job at the University of Buffalo?
I think that's a big deal. You know, when they came over, he had talked about like he likes consistency in his staff as well because they all know how to talk with each other. They all know the kind of terminology and the way that they work well. It is important, though, I think, to note that it was kind of a meshing, right, of what was at Buffalo. He brought about half of his staff from Buffalo. The other half was the guys that were here running the Jayhawks while, you know, for spring practice that year. And what that allowed them to do was hold on to a lot of the talent that had been brought in. The one thing I will say about Les Miles, he had absolutely no idea what to do with them on the field, but he was actually pretty good at bringing in guys that had a base level of talent. There just wasn't enough time while he was here for him to bring in enough of them. But the fact that he wasn't able to do anything with them, I think, would have kind of hindered the growth, right, of the roster in terms of restocking that roster, getting it back to where it needed to be. So it was almost like you never want a scandal like Les Miles had, especially at a different school, that affects the way that your coaching position is handled. But, you know, it actually allowed Kansas to capitalize on the talent that was brought in by Les Miles, but then give them the coaching consistency and the better understanding of how to utilize the, all the players that they actually have on the roster. I think the biggest underrated thing, and we actually kind of talked about this on my recap episode with Kyle Davis over on the Rock Talk podcast this week. I don't know that we give the coaching staff enough credit for what they've done over there. The way they've been able to make that consistently, to build the game plan around the ability to do a ton of different things. They have been very, very upfront about the fact that the way that they teach this is we're going to take as many guys as we think can play and find ways to get them on the field. The understanding and the selflessness that this team has, I don't think there's a single player that doesn't feel like they should be playing more, but two, understands that having more people that can help the team helps the team even more. I don't think I've ever seen that before. And I think the consistency that they've had and the ability to turn around or to have two successful programs with this entire coaching staff together has been extremely helpful to get that message across. The other thing that they've talked about is that this is not just the coaches themselves that are like teaching what's going on or, taking ownership for how the schemes look. They're actually involving the players. The players are, I think one of my favorite quotes was Jim Panagos, one of the line coaches. He was talking about how he went to go teach something after a drill because he saw a player doing something wrong. And one of the upperclassmen was already laying into the guy and telling him what he needed to be doing and helping to correct it and teach him how to do it. He's like, half the time I don't have anything to do because before I can get over there, they're actually already doing it for me. And that's the perfect kind of situation that you want, where the coaches and the players have that synergy, know what it is that they're wanting to teach, and the coaches don't have to dictate how that goes or always be the ones teaching. The guys can get their own feedback. They can, find what they're doing wrong and find ways to fix it. And the coaches are really there to kind of help guide that evolution process.
So according to SP Plus last year, only four teams finished the season with worse defenses than the Jayhawks. So we talked about earlier, I know Lance Leipold added a number of transfers on the defensive side of the ball during the offseason, and is exciting and I think is a genuinely good sign that Kansas is going to be turned around to the staff sooner than later. As exciting as that win was over West Virginia, giving up 42 points in regulation probably isn't the strongest sign that the defense is fully realized yet under the staff. So I would ask, what concerns you the most about this Kansas defense going up against Houston on Saturday?
I do think that at least part of what Kansas struggled with on West Virginia is that they definitely focused a lot on trying to take away the run because West Virginia has a lot of really good runners. They did struggle actually getting to the quarterback and finishing against the quarterback because West Virginia has a fairly good offensive line. What I think we saw was that there were some opportunities that Kansas kind of slipped up on early. But they didn't let that really get to them. I think the thing that worries me the most is not like attitude. It's not anything like that. I think it's literally just the fact that there is some sort of, I'm trying to think of the best way to actually say this, but they're like the fact that this team has some things that they have not seen yet that I don't know how effective they're going to be like when that actually happens. So, JT Daniels is a decent quarterback, but I do think that Kansas was able to pressure him to where he was not able to make pretty good decisions in a lot of instances. My impression of Houston, at least what I've seen, is that the offensive line is pretty good, that there's, some issues like every team has. But from what I can tell, the offensive line is even better for Houston than it was for West Virginia. So we'll have to see kind of how all of that comes together. But I think that's my biggest worry, is that they're not going to be able to pressure Tune in this game, which is going to allow him opportunities that he needs to find holes in the defense. Because no matter how good your defensive secondary is, if you can't make the quarterback make a decision, he's going to find a hole eventually. And I don't think Kansas has gone up against a team yet that has been able to stop the pressure for long enough to start opening up those holes.
All right, Andy, we very much appreciate you coming on, giving us the scoop on the Kansas Jayhawks. Let the folks listening know where they can find your podcast, find you online, find you on social media, that kind of thing.
Yeah, of course. You can find the Rock Chalk Podcast on the 1012 Podcast Network, wherever you get your podcasts. You can find us on Twitter at Rock Chalk Pod. I personally am Andy Mitch 12 on Twitter, and I do run the SI Fan Nation site, Blue Wings Rising. That's on Twitter at Blue Wings Rise. Or you can go to www.bluewingsrising.com to get all of our coverage on Kansas. And of course, make sure you come over and listen to the episode that we're doing with you guys, you know, previewing Houston, looking at this game, you know, kind of getting the other side there so that we can talk about all aspects of this game. Because, man, this is going to be a good one.
You never want to go too crazy over two game sample sizes, even though, you know, we're approaching this weekend 25% of the regular season schedule, which in itself is not an insignificant sample size. I think it's easy for me to buy into the fact that Kansas could be, you know, legitimately difficult, tricky opponent. It's just because, you know, we just don't have two varying degrees of good data points in the, you know, the current season. It's because I think you were starting to see at the end of last year, and that's why it's easy for me to buy in. We kind of talked about it with Andy. You saw the positive trend lines kind of the end of last year, and now you have two pretty, you know, A-plus data points in terms of what you would have expected from Kansas football you know, thus far. And you know, there's the obvious also that for the first time since Mark Mangino, you know, Kansas head coach Lance Leipold is actually, you know, way more qualified than his immediate predecessors to make this kind of turnaround happen. And so, Dustin, I guess when we start here, you know, obviously we've seen this Cougar team get tested by two varying degrees of good opponent. You know, do you think this Kansas team is, you know, is more similar to the UTSA and Texas Tech teams we just saw, or do you think they're more similar to, you know, some of the more manageable, you know, American Conference games that we maybe have coming up a bit later?
No, I think you would have to say that it's a pretty comparable game to UTSA and Texas Tech. And I think we both kind of expressed surprise that after both of those games had, you know, Vegas lines that, you know, were pretty close to, you know, 3 or 4 points, that this one came out around double digits in favor of Houston. And man, if you could give me that 10-point Houston win in this one, I'd be thrilled, because this Kansas team looks pretty legit going back to the end of last season, you know, and then, you know, the crushing of Tennessee Tech and the overtime win at West Virginia. And I mean, it's, you know, not only beating West Virginia like they did to open the Big 12 slate, but doing so on the road, you know, I think tells you that this is a Kansas team that's not going to be afraid to come into to TDECU Stadium. And as much as getting the loss versus Tech wasn't the kind of data result that you want for Houston, I think all of a sudden that result does put a little bit more pressure on you in this one to not drop, you know, back-to-back games against your future conference brethren. And as much as we've talked up Tech, I think Tech is a good team, and we're talking up Kansas here. I think Kansas is a good team. I think Lance Leipold's a really good coach, and he's someone that if he was running the Houston football program, I'd be excited to have him. You know, I like the guy we got, but if for whatever reason Houston was looking for a coach, you know, that's someone I'd be thrilled to have him there. So I think Kansas football should certainly be thrilled to have him. It seems like I kind of thought he might get Kansas football competitive sooner or later, but it certainly looks like they are really ahead of schedule, and Jalen Daniels being someone that I think can hurt the Cougars. We've seen them get pressure on the quarterback, but sometimes have a hard time, like we've talked about, bringing the quarterback down, actually finishing those tackles, actually bringing the guy back down to the backfield and not letting him, you know, break free and scramble. Jalen Daniels is someone that can really test you like that. So I think there's really, really plenty to be concerned about heading into this game. And, you know, I think Kansas may have the worst defense of these the three teams. I'd hope so. Otherwise, I think Houston might be in trouble because we need a better offensive result for Houston. But, you know, I think that there are more similarities than differences between, in terms of, you know, overall talent level from this Kansas team and what Houston has seen the last couple of weeks.
For anyone hoping that after the first 2 weeks against UTSA and Tech, that the Cougar defense would be getting a break from a mobile quarterback who could cause problems. I have some bad news about that, as we've established pretty well between, you know, Andy's interview and here. Daniels is a true dual threat and a guy who can throw the ball as well, had 3 touchdown passes and no picks, rushed for 85 yards, you know, over 7 yards an attempt last week in their win up in Morgantown. I will say, tendency-wise, the Jayhawks are a bit more run-first than UTSA or Tech, who I think those two teams will be among the leading programs in pass yards per game when it's all said and done this year. But if the Cougar defense doesn't do a dramatically better job handling Daniels as a dual threat on Saturday than they did with Frank Harris and Donovan Smith, I don't think we'll be feeling any better about the Cougar defense come early next week, even if it's a win when it's all said and done. And it's not just Dayden Daniels in the run game. KU's been able to lean on a pair of sophomores, Devin Neal, Daniel Hyshaw, for a balanced and pretty punishing run game. It's among the D1 team rushing leaders. To this point, though, you know, worth noting, one of those was Tennessee Tech. And we've mentioned it. I think the Cougar defense has done actually a pretty good job against the run when it's not a quarterback improvising. But, you know, the rub here is that Jayden Daniels is absolutely the kind of quarterback who can escape pressure and improvise in the running game. If I had to guess, Luke Grimm and Quentin Skinner will get their most targets out of the receivers. And, you know, yes, I said earlier that they are maybe a bit more run first, but they're still going to throw the ball a fair amount. This is not going to be a run the ball 75% kind of an opponent. I'm really impressed also, you know, thus far, that, you know, no matter who they've played in the last 2 games, that the Kansas offensive line has not allowed Daniels to get sacked once through 8 quarters of football. You know, that's not nothing. Obviously, the Cougar defensive front is going to present a different level of challenge for the KU offensive line than what Tennessee Tech or West Virginia could do. And I think if U of H wants to control this game, keep from being the, you know, third week in a row of a very close, heartburn-inducing finish, we have to see the Cougar defensive front disrupt. Get an offense that's a bit more run first by tendency than your last 2 opponents in long down and distance situations, to get them passing maybe a tad more than they're comfortable with. And not to mention, I think having a better plan for the long down distances, having a better plan for the late game if it's a bit closer. I think that's gonna be the fun matchup when Kansas's offense is on the field and Houston's defense is on the field, because, you know, I think through 2 weeks that's been each team's best unit. And just worth reiterating that if you think this is going to be an easy kind of Saturday for the Cougar defense, I don't think you're appreciating that this opponent really has figured things out on the offensive side of the ball. But, you know, I think if the Cougar defense can get consistent pressure, make KU a bit more pass-first than they like to be, you know, I think that could be the Cougars' recipe to winning this game and winning it with a bit less stress than we experienced the prior 2 weeks.
And then when you look at the other side of the ball, that's where I think Houston really needs to have a strong game. And you know, there's been plenty of consternation about some of the offensive struggles the first 2 weeks. We've certainly not been afraid to say that the Houston offense has been a little disappointing at times in the first 2 weeks, while also acknowledging that they went, you know, on the road and played a couple of true road games. And you know what? Maybe UTSA and Texas Tech both end up having better defenses, you know, on the balance over the course of the season than they had a year ago. But, you know, playing Kansas at home and, you know, with no, not to entirely, I was going to say not to disrespect, but I am about to disrespect them a little bit. Not to entirely disrespect this Kansas defense, but it was one of the worst defenses in the country last year. Gave up 42 points in the opener to West Virginia. If Houston comes out at home in the home opener against this Kansas defense and puts up a single-digit number of points in the first half again, you know, I think that's going to take a significant turn from, you know, mildly concerning or moderately concerned where I am now to extremely concerning and lots and lots of questions to answer about this this Cougar offense. Because, you know, not just in terms of needing a momentum breaker after the 2 disappointing first halves of the season, it really, the second half offensive, it wasn't that great last week either. So really, I'd say we've seen, you know, probably 1 strong offensive half out of 4 from this Cougar offense thus far. You know, if we're not able to see this team, this Cougar team, score in the 30s and scoring in the 30s in regulation because they're actually putting scoring drives together, then I think we're coming back a week from now and legitimately pushing the panic button, whereas maybe at the moment we're just kind of keeping an eye on the panic button.
You know, it's hard to be too optimistic about a Cougar offense that through 2 games so far has given you a number of reasons not to be optimistic, but I also don't think I'm being overly dismissive of our opponents to say that Kansas will probably have a worse defense than UTSA or Texas Tech this year when it's all said and done. And that's not a knock on the Jayhawks. That's not a knock on the Lance Leipold staff. I think it just underscores actually how remarkable it's been that on the other side of the ball, KU is showing this much progress offensively 2 years into, you know, what no one will argue looked like one of college football's hardest rebuilds. And I will say also one counterpoint to, I guess, me positing there that this defense isn't very good. The Jayhawks, you know, held a West Virginia rushing attack that, you know, at times in week one really ran roughshod over Pitt, especially C.J. Donaldson, held the Mountaineers as a team to under 4 yards per carry, didn't allow a run longer than 10 yards all game. That's not music to your ears when you, you know, think about the fact that U of H might only have a couple healthy scholarship running backs for Saturday's game, with Tayson Henry and Brandon Campbell dealing with some degree of injury. And if this Cougar offensive line, though, can keep Clayton Tune clean more often than not, can consistently pass block, and I think worth mentioning that Kansas didn't generate a sack and only had, I think, one tackle for loss total against West Virginia, then, you know, the big possible mismatch could end up being this Cougar passing attack against the Jayhawks Hawks secondary. I mean, you do have to go back to last season to have any consistently strong data points about this Cougar passing offense, though, you know, we'll say Kansas in their one offense against or one matchup against an FBS offense this year did surrender 355 pass yards and almost 9 yards per attempt to West Virginia and JT Daniels. If this Cougar offense doesn't do demonstrably better at home against Kansas than they did last week against Texas Tech in that first two or three quarters against UTSA, it's panic button territory. Like you said, it goes beyond red flag status. I think at that point, we have to start asking serious questions about whether this will be even an average passing offense in 2022, you know, if you can't make things happen against the Jayhawks. And that's not to say, you know, there aren't positives in that defense. I say guys like Kobe Bryant, who had the, you know, game-sealing interception in OT against West Virginia, or Kenny Logan Jr., can't cause problems for a fairly young Cougar receiver group outside of Tank Dell and Keshawn Carter. But again, I don't feel like I'm being unfair in saying that this absolutely must be a game where we see some offensive progress beyond what we saw in weeks one and two.
Yeah, and, you know, I think one other area that I'm kind of curious to see how things turn out on Saturday is the home crowd. We've heard Dana Holgorsen talk about it during media availability this week. Dana, I really don't remember in my recollection that he's really made a big point to talk about, you know, crowd sizes during his Houston tenure here. But, you know, I appreciate that it's not when Houston thinks about moving to the Big 12 to play Kansas football is not the reason why you move to the Big 12. But, you know, you've got the Big 12 news. You know, this is a your Houston program. You need to start treating it and supporting it like it's a Big 12 program, regardless of who the opponent is. And yes, we'll get some more enticing Big 12 programs into TDECU Stadium next year than the Kansas Jayhawks. But, you know, this is, like I said, Houston's kind of gotten what they finally want in terms of the big conference affiliation. So, you know, for the Houston faithful, that means support this. You need to start supporting this program like a Big 12 program. So if this is you know, some sub 30,000 turnout on Saturday, I think would be an extremely disappointing result and not the best sign for where this fan base is at on the eve of a Big 12 membership.
And you know what, like, that Texas Tech loss was super frustrating. You could listen to me last week and talk about how much that game bothered me in real time and after the fact, but if this fan base is showing up with fewer than 30,000 people for the home opener off the season we had last year, with, you know, really every goal just about still in front of this team, if this is a less than 30,000 crowd because you guys are that mad about an overtime loss to Texas Tech, I'll go further than you, Justin. This is a soft fan base. If I can travel halfway across the country to be at this home opener, you can get down there from the Woodlands or Katy or whatever new suburbs have popped up in the 6 years or so since I've lived there. You can be there, you know, whatever. If this weekend goes badly, and if you're just like, I don't know if this team really has the goods to make me want to spend all my Saturdays, fine, whatever. But this team needs you week three at home here. This team needs a good crowd. You're going to have the Houston Heat. This is, you know, a better opponent than you would think when you see Kansas on the schedule. And no matter what, it's the home opener. Be there. Support the guys. If I can be there, you can as well. That's my pep talk. I'm not a natural pep talk giver, Dustin, but it's frustrating to see so many people just be like, they lost a Tech. I just don't really have any interest in the rest of the season. If that was what, you know, broke your interest in the season, your interest really wasn't that strong to begin with.
I mean, this team lost to Texas Tech early last year and then ended up going, you know, 12-2 and being a top 25 team. So if you're bailing on this team after the loss of Texas Tech, then I don't know, be better.
Don't jump back on. That's my last advice to you. Don't jump back on. You're probably not listening an hour into a podcast if you're not that person. So I do realize the irony of me, you know, chiding casual fans an hour into this podcast. But, you know.
We might be preaching a little bit to the choir at this
point.
All right. And then did want to talk about looking around the rest of college football for week three. And man, this week sure feels backloaded with some good games on Saturday evening, but not really a whole lot that grabs my attention. Before then, Friday evening, your games are Florida State, Louisville, and Air Force, Wyoming. I don't know, Sam, this might be a good evening to build up some goodwill with your significant other or friend or roommate or whoever. If someone maybe doesn't like college football quite as much as you do, maybe give them the remote on Friday and find something else to watch.
Yeah, exactly. Like, Air Force Wyoming like might be entertaining, but I would co-sign everything you said. Like, it doesn't have to be college football every night, and frankly, this is a decent opportunity to not oversaturate your life with college football.
And then same thing, I don't know, Saturday at 11 a.m., the picking's really pretty slim there.
Trash time slot.
I mean, like, Cincinnati's at Miami of Ohio, Oklahoma at Nebraska. You got a couple of, you know, really long-standing rivalry games there.
Oklahoma-Nebraska, because apparently this is 1997, and that's a compelling game still.
Yeah, but I don't know. I expect the road team to triumph fairly easily in both of those games. So I don't know how, you know, you might tune in for the uniforms and then watch a couple of series and realizes that neither of these games are going to be particularly close. And then at 1 o'clock, keeping an eye on Old Dominion at Virginia, kind of intrigued to see if the Monarchs can beat both Virginia Tech and Virginia in the same season. Kind of cool, ODU actually plays all four other Virginia FBS teams this year, so I didn't know that I needed an Old Dominion State of Virginia or Commonwealth of Virginia championship, but now I'm kind of rooting for it.
Yeah, I'm going to keep half an eye on Tulane K-State if that one's competitive after half, which I'm not saying necessarily is, but just, you know, one to watch if the Greenies make that one competitive. BYU-Oregon might be decently entertaining, though BYU might be like a good deal better than Oregon, though obviously a bit of a hangover after just a super emotional win over Baylor at home. This slate is so bad, Dustin, I don't feel bad mentioning this game because UNLV is hosting North Texas out here in Vegas this Saturday. UNLV is still a favorite in that one. It's wild to me that UNLV, this just perennially not good Division I program, was a 3-point favorite to open against a 2021 bowl team. Just want to mention, also, UNLV stay within a touchdown at Cal, so maybe the Running Rebels have the goods this year. But the fact that I am not getting shouted down by you for bringing this game up, I think tells you everything you need to know about the early to, you know, mid-afternoon Saturday slate outside of your Cougars.
And so I am intrigued by the 2 o'clock kick, Tulane at Kansas State, Greenway is coming off that.
Yeah, I mentioned that.
Yeah, like you said, the two and ten season, already 2-0 this year after blowing up UMass and Alcorn State. Obviously, a significant step up in competition. K State looks pretty good, fresh off of thrashing Mizzou. And then you also mentioned BYU at Oregon. You know, Cougs riding high off the Baylor win, Oregon. I was kind of surprised. I didn't even notice the result until I went back and looked. After getting absolutely demolished by Georgia in the opener and ahead of facing a pretty good BYU team, you think maybe they get a trap game in week two facing Eastern Washington, who's, you know, been one of the better FCS teams the last several years, and the Ducks hung 70 on them. So that's, you know, you can only glean so much against an FCS game, but that's a pretty resounding, you know, bounce back from the just woodshedding that they got from Georgia. So Vegas actually likes Oregon by a couple points in this one, but if BYU can pull this one off, they're 3-0 with a couple of nice wins and no unwinnable games left on the schedule.
Yeah, never an easy place to play, to be sure.
Yeah. And then as we get into the evening slot, 6 o'clock, you got Texas Tech at NC State. Really interesting game for me. Would love to see the Red Raiders obviously pick up a road win against a top 15 NC State team and kind of make that Houston loss in Lubbock look a little bit better. NC State, you know, it's a team with a lot of preseason hype, and certainly they haven't lost yet, so they get to keep that ranking. But, you know, we saw them early on really struggle with East Carolina, so definitely curious to see what the Red Raiders are able to do out there against NC State.
Yeah, NC State, you know, looked pretty vulnerable in week one against ECU. It will be a little bit different because they'll be at home in Raleigh. There's like three different games in this general time of evening where I'm just like, I have no idea how these teams connected for a non-conference game, but I'm glad they did because I think it's actually going to be like a reasonably entertaining game. That Texas Tech passing offense against a pretty stout-looking NC State defense so far. Wanted to jump to one of those other games for me, Dustin. Michigan State at Washington, a Washington team that's looked surprisingly decent early on with former Indiana quarterback Michael Penix Jr., former Fresno State head coach Kalen DeBoer there. A lot of people said Washington was going to be one of those teams that looked really bad in 2021 and turned around pretty quickly in the new coaching change. Michigan State, you know, was a real surprise breakout team a year ago. I think that's going to be a fun one. I think one worth keeping half an eye on, maybe a good second screen candidate kind of game there.
Yeah, I'm intrigued by that one. I'm also intrigued by another kind of like, I'm not sure how that non-conference game happened, but SMU at Maryland.
Yep, that's my third. Yep.
At 6:30 as well. Not sure how those teams got on the schedule, but you know, both teams that are 2-0 after, you know, running up some big scores against some maybe kind of middling to low level competition. So definitely, I think the hardest game of the season thus far for either team. And you know, in terms of SMU really being one of the teams that I think has a chance to threaten in the American Athletic Conference this year, definitely interested to see how they do with a pretty lengthy road trip. Another conference game in that 6:30 time slot makes a little more sense that one got scheduled, but UCF at FAU, the Owls really no great shakes, but UCF, you know, you got to figure maybe a little bit low on confidence after a stunning home loss versus Louisville last week. So going on the road to FAU, not a long road trip, but I am kind of curious to see if UCF is able to get right against a team that they probably should comfortably beat, or if you know, if they're struggling in this one. I think that maybe indicates that, you know, some of the issues we saw against Louisville were not you know, one time you know, one offs.
Yeah, very early on and not against any really good opponents, but FAU is looking a bit more like, you know, a good Willie Taggart team, like USF era Willie Taggart than any of his last several years. They look like they finally have an identity offensively, and old friend Todd Orlando has done a pretty decent job with their defense through the first few games of the season. Nice little matchup there between the offensive mind of Gus Malzahn and the defensive mind of Todd Orlando.
And then kicking off just a little bit later at 7 o'clock, we've got UTSA at UT Austin. The Longhorns, of course, entering the top 25 after a loss, after playing competitively against Alabama. So, you know, every single week of every single college football season, whoever is playing against the team wearing burnt orange has my rooting interest that week, but obviously doubly true in a year when it's a UTSA team that Houston already has a win against and a UTSA team that I think it's not completely out of the question to think that they could be competitive in this one.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about, you know, hangover games earlier, but, like, I think, you know, coming off, you know, facing the national number one Alabama and just getting all the attention that game got and having it be this just incredibly close emotional loss, I'm not saying that's going to, you know, mean the Longhorns are going to get upset here. I would say, if I was still living in Central Texas, I would absolutely have been spending the last few weeks hitting our friend Jared up for tickets. I would have absolutely gone to that one at DKR, like head to toe in UTSA stuff. There would be no funnier outcome. I don't know if it goes so far as to say this season, but there would be very few funnier outcomes to me than UTSA beating Texas at DKR. Just what I would give to see that happen.
I well, when I was at the Alamo Dome on opening weekend, I grabbed one of the UTSA rally towels that they were giving away. So best believe I'll have that one with me and we'll be waving it frantically with for every play, rooting on other Roadrunners in this one. And then the only night game one that I really have circled is Fresno State at USC. Despite the loss at Oregon State last week, I still think this is a pretty good Fresno State team. And despite USC's win over Stanford, not convinced that this is number 17 in the country, USC right now. Feels like a bit much after the year that they had last year, having only gotten the two wins so far. But, you know, kind of maybe some similarities between the UTSA-UT Austin game, where you'd probably expect the, you know, the team at home, which is, you know, one of the, you know, kind of blue bloods in the sport, to probably take care of business against a 1-1 mid-major school. But definitely, I think Fresno State, like we said, has the talent to make this one competitive, and wouldn't be surprised to see this one relatively close.
Yeah, higher entertainment value game, if nothing else. Jake Haener, Fresno State's quarterback, is a really fun watch. USC's offense, you know, even two games in under Lincoln Riley, you know, looks like he's been there 4 years. Real fun there. Jordan Addison, Mario Williams, and of course, the quarterback who followed him from Oklahoma, Caleb Williams. I think if nothing else, I think it's going to be a USC win, but I think it'll be pointsy. I think it'll be high on the entertainment value. USC isn't a very good defensive team. I think it's kind of the platonic ideal of a later in the evening West Coast game, even if I think neither of us are optimistic about the upset happening.
Yeah, the freaking Miami A&M game is in the evening as well. How is A&M still in the top 25? I'm asking you after that win. Again, complaining about the top 25 polls is always just kind of pointless, especially this early in the year. But how? And again, normally I just can't really be bothered to care about Miami and A&M. But if nothing else, just I want to see the Aggies lose again just to get that undeserved number removed from next third team name.
But Dustin, Jimbo Fisher won a national championship 10 years ago on an entirely different team. You got to give them that 10 years ago national championship respect.
You got to give them the 10 years ago national championship respect
and another school.
All the recruiting championships that they have as well. Definitely should matter more than the home loss to an App State team that lost to UNC. But that's fine.
Yep, no doubt. Yep.
All right. Anyway, that petty bitterness is where we're going to go ahead and end this episode because why not? I think that's a fair representation of this podcast. No, it does. Either way, we are going to go ahead and end it there. As always, on the way out, I want to give a huge thank you to our Scott and Holman podcast Patreon supporters whose continued support of this podcast is just unbelievably appreciated by both Sam and myself. If you do enjoy this podcast on a regular basis and if you are at financially a point in your life where you feel like you can afford a couple bucks a month, we would love for you to go to shpodcast.com/support. You can find a link to make a recurring monthly donation on Patreon. You can send us a one-time tip via PayPal, or you can buy some merchandise with our street sign logo on it. All those methods of support very much appreciated, as are the methods of support that are writing us a 5-star review on your app of choice or by going to homefieldapparel.com and using promo code Holman12 at checkout. We also love hearing from you, the Scott and Holman podcast listener. You can email us shpodcast@gmail.com or you can tweet at us at shpodcast. If you made it all the way to the end of this episode, you are absolutely amazing and I love you. And as always,
go Cougs.
Go Cougs.
Vamos los Cougs.
Go Cougs.
Go Cougs.
Go Cougs.
We ain't invited to the party. We had to kick the door in. No cap. No cap. No cap.